Broadcasting live from the Buckhead Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Legal Experts.
Good morning. It's Emily Rowell with Peachtree Offices, and welcome to another episode of Atlanta Legal Experts. We're excited to be here today, and I've got Rich Casanova here in the studio, co-host.
Man, I'm excited to be here. I had an interesting story.
At least you got here.
Yeah, the transportation. I took everything except for an airplane to get here this morning, but very excited to be here. We've got a great lineup of guests, and I might have a few questions, but Emily, it's all yours.
Great. And Atlanta Legal Experts radio show has actually been featured on Atlanta's John Marshall Law School website, the Georgia Trial Lawyers Association website, and more recently, the Yahoo Finance page. So we're making it
big.
Yeah. And today we have John Camp with Westmoreland, Patterson, Mosley, and Henson.
Good morning. How you doing?
We have Sean Southworth and Tarina Williams with Southworth PC.
Good morning.
And we have Benin Brown, who has had to take his child to school and will be here any moment.
He should be landing on the helipad in just a moment, yeah.
And he's with Brown Webb Copy. So I'm going to go ahead and start with attorney Sean Southworth. He is the founding attorney of Southworth PC. As an employment attorney, his practice focuses on representing employees and former employees in all areas of employment law. He carefully selects his clients and aggressively and doggedly represents them. When justice requires, he enjoys taking on any employer from large Fortune 500 companies to large governmental agencies. For his clients, he has not only obtained dispositive results, but also substantial 5- and 6-figure settlements that have changed the way the workplace is structured and that have allowed his clients to continue working under their terms. Mr. Southworth is a graduate of the Duke University School of Law, where at graduation he received the Faculty Award for Outstanding Achievement in Labor and Employment Law. As an employment attorney, Sean has represented clients in almost all areas of law, including, just to name a few, sexual harassment, racial harassment, disability harassment, and much, much more. He is also an honors graduate of Grinnelly College, and if you wanted to read his entire bio, we will have that on our website, and I'm sure he'll mention his website at the end of his interview. I'm going to go ahead and talk about Tarina, who works with Sean. Tarina Williams is an associate attorney at Southworth PC. Ms. Williams represents employees and former employees in all areas of employment law as well, including but not limited to racial harassment and discrimination, sexual harassment and discrimination, retaliation, and wage and hour disputes. Ms. Williams is an alumnus of the University of California, Hastings College of the Law, where she received the highest grade in multiple courses and received the best brief award in moot court. Upon completing her law degree, Ms. Williams obtained her LLM in taxation from Golden Gate University School of Law, where she graduated with honors. Prior to joining Southworth PC, Ms. Williams was an associate attorney at a well-respected employment and civil rights litigation firm in California. Ms. Williams is committed to her work as an employment attorney and looks forward to working with you on your employment-related needs. Those are some experts for sure. Thank you for being here.
No problem. It's great to be here.
Sean, what is the difference between representing federal employees and private sector employees based in Georgia?
Yeah, that is a very big difference. So in addition to representing Georgia employees who are in the private sector, we also represent federal employees nationwide, and we even have some federal employee clients stationed abroad. And it's a huge difference between them because basically most employees in the state of Georgia can be disciplined or fired for any reason, no reason, or a bad reason unless it's specifically prohibited by law. And that's a lawyer answer there. So it's okay unless it's illegal. But so what does that mean? For the most part, usually it's certain specific things, and this is not a complete list, but you know, you can't terminate somebody because of their race, their gender, their religion, their national origin, and a series of other factors like that, disability, you know, filing a wage and hour complaint or because of taking FMLA leave. However, that's very different for federal employees. And it varies by agency and it varies by type of federal employee. But most of them, and it's part of it, the deal with federal employment is that they can only be terminated if it promotes the efficiency of the service. So instead of being what we would call at will, there, for many federal employees, the agency has to actually charge them with certain types of misconduct and then prove that. In addition to, you know, other arguments that we can make. So, further federal employees have to go through kind of a different process for the most part for the processing of EEO complaints or appearing before the Merit Systems Protection Board that private sector employees don't get into. And there's a bunch of different deadlines involved that are very short for federal employees. For instance, a Georgia private employee, if they have a discrimination complaint, generally they have 180 days to bring that to the attention of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. That might not always be necessary, for instance, in cases of race discrimination, because mm-hmm. there's separate protections for that. However, for federal employees, many of them have to bring a discrimination complaint, for the most part, generally within 45 days wow. of when that actually occurs. And so, you know, for most people, they don't necessarily know at that point.
Right. You would think that it would be the opposite, where the governmental employees would be longer, the federal employees would be a longer time that they get to report anything because of how long the government takes to do anything.
Very good point. And part of it, I think, is it's a different system. So there's federal employees can't get certain types of damages, such as punitive damages. Mm-hmm. And the federal government actually is more investigated to actually investigating discrimination complaints. So I think it's kind of a flip side. But it is a really short deadline. It's mm-hmm. pretty unfortunate, in my opinion.
Right. So, Tarina, tell me this. If more than 45 days have passed since a federal employee believes the discrimination, harassment, or retaliation began, do they have any options?
You definitely want to give us a call still to talk about your case, because there may be a situation where the 45-day period has passed, but it can be told or waived under certain circumstances. So one of the big circumstances is continuing violations. And in that theory, one of the discriminatory events must occur within the 45-day period, but other events that may have passed, they can still be a part of that claim, even though it was 45 days, ago. Mm-hmm. That kind of claim, it usually occurs in hostile work environment claims where you're saying that your environment over a long period of time has sure. been hostile. And it also can occur in reasonable accommodation claims. And in that sense, you're saying, well, if you say my agency has failed to reasonably accommodate me, then each new day can be a failure and can be a new discriminatory event. So, some people may not know that.
Right.
So then there's also three other theories upon which the 45-day period can be told. One of them is tolling. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, sometimes it's you get into a situation where you were not aware that something was discriminatory. And that usually occurs in non-selection cases.
Okay.
Where you were not selected, but you wouldn't know if it was discriminatory until the actual person, another person was selected, and you learn of their race or their sex or their gotcha. Age. And once you learn of it, then that's when the 45-day period would start. There's also a waiver, and in waiving, there could be a situation where you're on active military duty, and if you're in abroad, then your time period is waived, and okay. once you come back, you can go ahead and file your complaint. It could also be a situation of mental duress or physical inability to file your complaint, and certain small circumstances are they may waive your 45-day time limit if there was new employees who may not have known about the time limit.
Right.
But, you know, that's not always going to happen. Very limited circumstances will that happen.
But that's why we do free consultations, because there are some exceptions that people probably wouldn't know about. But the timelines are quick. So if, you know, any suspicion is there, feel free to give us a call and we'll see if we can help.
I would say that wouldn't you want to definitely keep all records and write everything down, no matter what you think, if you're allowed to, you know, report it or not, just go ahead and keep as many records as you can?
Yeah, you want to keep records. For certain federal employees, they have access to certain confidential information that might be a little bit tricky, so feel free to give us a call about that. But being very organized is definitely helpful in keeping your chronology of events. Just helps people. And that once you start looking at chronologies, facts jump out and you can start understanding what people were actually doing a little bit better.
So, that's a good point. Yeah. And that actually makes it easier for you.
Yes, much easier.
Tarina, tell me one more thing. For federal employees, what are some of the damages available to help restore justice for discrimination, harassment, and retaliation?
So one of the big forms of relief is compensatory damages. And, you know, that really comes in two forms, out-of-pocket expenses, such as medical expenses, you know, job search expenses. But it also comes in getting compensation for the emotional distress that you were under for the discriminatory event occurring. And this can be in loss of enjoyment of life, injury to your professional standing, loss of health, mental anguish, and other things like that. So you can get compensated for those non-pecuniary expenses. You can also be awarded back pay if the situation's warranted. And, you know, those that kind of happens in removals or suspensions, demotions, where you can be awarded back pay. You can also have a situation where the personnel action can be rescinded. So if you are removed or are demoted or suspended, they can take that back if it's proven to be discriminatory and all the references to it in your personnel file will be removed. There's also declaratory and injunctive relief where the judge can order the agency to do something, such as giving a complainant reasonable accommodations. And then, you know, you can also get attorney's fees. It's a little different under the Age Discrimination and Employment Act. You are able to get liquidated damages rather than compensatory damages. And liquidated damages, that will be double of your back pay. Unfortunately, punitive damages are not available for federal employees. And as much as we would like apologies, those are not a form of relief that you can get either.
Sean, tell me, I see on your website that you offer free consultations for federal employees. I know you talked about that a little bit before, but also in your bio, it says that, you know, you really carefully choose what cases you take on. Tell me what, basically, what do you look for in a case that makes you want to take it on?
That's a great question. So just before we even think about the merits, I need to like the person, and that's kind of really important. You know, there are plenty of, I mean, there's not as many federal employee attorneys because it's kind of specialized, but there's plenty of them. There are plenty of good ones. But you, when you have an attorney-client relationship, really want to work with somebody who you can trust. You have to be on the same page. It's like you tell your doctor everything, you tell your attorney everything. So we're looking for people that we really like. That's important to us. But when we're, you know, focusing on selecting clients, we're also really looking for violations of the law. So if we're going to talk about wrongful termination and removal where you have rights before the Merit Systems Protection Board, we're really interested in looking at the proposal. We're interested in looking at what the specific charge was, and we can assess that based on different decisions that the Merit Systems Protection Board has done. But a big thing, essentially, you know, generally the agency has to prove the charges. So if the employee's sitting there thinking these aren't true, this is not true, then that's a great thing for us. And if we can prove it's not true, or we can stop the agency from proving by preponderant evidence that it's true, then that is a case that we would be very interested in taking. And so that's why we do free consultations, because sometimes there are technical things that people don't know happened. Mm-hmm. For instance, we recently had a victory before the Merit Systems Protection Board where our client's removal was reversed. He was given back pay and attorney's fees because the agency committed a due process violation. Essentially, the deciding official considered evidence without giving a chance to our client to respond to that evidence. That's very technical. He probably wouldn't have known that. On the other hand, some are very outrageous. We had a case where somebody was removed purportedly for sexual harassment based on a smile and sticking out his tongue, allegedly didn't even happen. But, you know, I can't really imagine how, even if it's really gross, like sticking out a tongue, how can that constitute sexual harassment? So, you know, if that were the, by the way, if that somebody called in and just like somebody stuck their tongue out at me, we would not take that case. So very hard to do. So, again, we're looking for people that we like. If you think it's discrimination, think how are you being treated differently than other people?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's a good point.
One thing that stands out to us is retaliation, because that happens a lot. Essentially, the law says you shouldn't face reprisal because you went to the EEOC or filed a complaint. And if you've done that and shortly thereafter something negative happened that's unusual, that timing, the knowledge of the individuals, the fact that they might have been a target, I mean, it's a very natural but unlawful thing to try to come after somebody if you think they're threatening you by going to raise a complaint of discrimination. So those are just some of the things that we're looking for. But, you know, it can be complex. So that's why we do offer a 10 or 15 minute screening consultation.
Gotcha. Well, there's so much experience I read about you on your website, and you also, Trina. And I'm amazed at all your experience and your knowledge, your wealth of knowledge. Tell me, how did you get into employment law?
Well, actually, I've been very interested. So it started in law school. You know, my second year, I started taking a bunch of labor and employment courses. And when you're going through law school, first year is a little boring, in my opinion. And you're like, well, there's a bunch of types of law I definitely don't want to practice. But, you know, I really like the personal aspects about labor employment. You know, the concept of civil rights, I think, is a great thing in our society where...
Sure.
You've got to be pretty advanced to be able to start to offer some of those protections. So that just excited me, and from there it just built.
Took off, yeah. Right. That's awesome. And if you wouldn't mind telling our listeners how they can get in touch with you so they can find out more.
Great. Well, you can always give us a call, 404-585-8095. If you're a federal employee, our website is attorneysforfederalemployees.com. Or you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/federalemployees. Or if you're a private sector employee in Georgia, the address is southworthpc.com.
Great. Thank you for being on the show. We look forward to having you back again. And I'm going to go with William John Camp. I think it's very similar but different, the practices that you guys have. John is a partner at Westmoreland, Patterson, Mosley & Henson, LLP in Macon, Georgia. His primary office is in Warner Robins. He is an experienced family law trial attorney. He provides consulting services to other lawyers on military and civil service retirement and other benefits. In a 71 high honors graduate of Auburn University, and in 1974, he graduated from the University of Georgia School of Law and was then designated as an Air Force judge advocate. John's diversity in practice while in the Air Force included serving as a special assistant U.S. attorney, trial and defense counsel in over 700 courts martial. Since 1995, John has devoted himself to the developing area of military and civil service family law. He is a recognized national expert on dividing federal retirement benefits, survivor annuities for former spouses, and post-divorce health care options in the federal, civilian, and military personnel systems. His ABA Family Law Quarterly article on health care options for former military spouses has become the go-to Bible for family law attorneys around the nation. Today, John is working on Georgia passing the Uniform Deployed Parents Custody and Visitation Act. Welcome.
Thank you.
Again, a very big experience, lots of experience and knowledge, and I would love to read the entire bio, but we will have it on our websites at atlantalegalexperts.com. Tell me about Georgia, and does it have a large military and federal civil service community?
Actually, Emily, Georgia is the fifth largest state in the nation in the size of its military communities. Almost 740,000 veterans are in Georgia. About 250,000 active duty, reserve, and National Guard service members and their dependents are here. And then we have a very, very large civil service community in Georgia stationed in all of the major areas. In fact, in every community, if you stop and think, the guy that delivers your mail every day, he is something like a federal employee.
Mm-hmm. What kind of numbers are we looking at?
Well, as I said, the numbers are quite large. In fact, you know, with all of them added together, you're looking at a market that's probably around 1.3 million across the strait with federal and military people.
So tell me, how significant are civil service and military retirement benefits in divorce and legal separations?
Well, when military people and civil service individuals get into a divorce, typically their largest marital asset is going to be their retirement benefits, their pensions, their health care benefits, the survivor annuities, life insurance programs under the Federal Employees Group Life Insurance, sometimes referred to as FIGLI. Military individuals have very large insurance policies too. Like every airman has typically $400,000 worth of life insurance, and if they die in a combat zone, there's a $100,000 death gratuity that goes to them. So every E1 who's 18 years old that goes in one of the branches of the armed forces automatically has an estate worth $500,000.
Wow. Well, so that definitely can play a huge part of when you're getting a divorce or separating.
Well, it really does. And let me tell you what, military and civil servant, military individuals and civil servants zealously guard those retirement assets. And sometimes it's like prying the death finger off of them when you go to try to divide them.
Sure, sure. Are there just pensions or is there something like a 401k that can also be on the divorce assets table?
Yes, there's something called the Thrift Savings Plan, and there's actually civilian thrift savings, and there's military thrift savings. They differ primarily in that under the Federal Employees Retirement System, or FERS retirement system that most federal employees are under today, the federal agency matches up to 5% of their contributions. Now, over a 20 or 30-year career, depending upon the pay grade of that federal employee, it can reach $500,000 itself.
Wow.
And then for military, there is no matching at present, and people can contribute to that voluntarily. And if they are in a combat zone, like we have a lot in Iraq, or did have in Iraq, and also in Afghanistan, if they have tax-free reenlistment bonuses or other types of bonuses that they receive, it goes into that TSP account almost like it was a Roth IRA.
Okay.
So it's significant too. So I've seen military TSP accounts at $500,000 to $750,000.
Wow. Does dividing these benefits in the event of a divorce require any special court orders?
Yes, most lawyers are familiar with the term quadros, or qualified domestic relations orders, which are actually a creature of the Employee Income and Retirement and Security Act. But ERISA did not apply to federal sector retirements. So in order to divide them, you typically want to have a special court order to divide those retirement benefits. Not necessarily for tax reasons, but more so to ensure that things don't happen after the divorce that impact upon what a former spouse received.
Gotcha.
Let me just say, Emily, the Congress did not create federal retirement benefits to give people something to fight over when they divorced.
Right.
And it is really an employment shaping tool. But there are many, many back doors that are available to both federal and civil service federal employees and military, which can unravel a judge's order. And one of those is the veterans' disability compensation. And let me just quickly say, you may have a 21-year National Guardsman who lost a leg in Afghanistan, and now he's applied for retirement. And he's also applied to the VA for disability compensation. if he had a long-term spouse and she got half of his military retirement, the results of his receiving VA disability compensation could reduce the ex-wife's share by a significant amount. So yeah. Drafting of these orders are very important. Some of the names we see, and I'll just tell you, a COAP, a court order acceptable for processing, is the vehicle by which the U.S. Office of Personnel Management accepts to divide retirements. The Defense Finance and Accounting Service and the United States Coast Guard Pay Center accept something called a Military Pension Division Order or Direct Pay Order. And then we have for the Thrift Savings Plan, a Thrift Savings Plan Retirement Benefit Order, a TSP REBO is what we call it. And I draft those, and I helped other lawyers draft them to make sure people get what they were awarded or what they negotiated for.
And I know that you also help teach other lawyers on how to do this. Are there many lawyers that know or have experience or expertise to draft these orders?
Unfortunately not, Emily. I'm just going to tell you, probably a third of my practice involves trying to rescue clients who unfortunately were represented by a lawyer that did not understand these retirement benefits. And I compare it to fixing a satellite that's on the other side of Mars. It is extremely difficult to fix them. Mm-hmm. And I have found that an ounce of prevention is worth 10 tons of cure. Mm-hmm. And lawyers, like everybody else, they tend to shy away from things they don't understand. But wanting business, they will represent that they know how to do them. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they don't.
Right.
And the unfortunate result is that people are either people lose a huge amount of marital assets in the process of divorce.
Right. That's too bad. What problems do you see for lawyers without experience attempting to represent clients for the lawyer?
Well, obviously, it's that dreaded word. It's called malpractice suit.
Right.
And there are cases around the country and some here in Georgia where lawyers have been sued for malpractice for not getting survivor benefits for a military client or a federal civil service client. People don't stop to think that unlike an ERISA retirement, when you divide it, then that division is permanent and you can get survivor annuity benefits for that former spouse in the military. If you don't get, and in the civil service practice, if you do not get the court to award or the parties to agree that the former spouse will have a survivor annuity benefit, then their share of the pension, the former spouse's share, ends upon the death of the employee of the military individual.
Oh,
and that's
scary.
A huge loss. Imagine
right.
Someone receiving $2,500 a month as part of a military retirement, and then that service member dies, and the ex-spouse is suddenly deprived $2,500 a month. It's
yeah.
large amounts of money.
Sure. Sure. Tell me, post-divorce health care for the non-employed spouse is always an important concern. You kind of touched on it earlier. Are there viable options for the non-employed former spouses of military and federal civil service workers?
Absolutely. And that's something which is really important. A lot of people feel like that Obamacare is their rescue and they can go to the health care website and be able to get something to help them. But nothing is better than the programs which the Department of Defense under its TRICARE system and the Federal Employees Health Benefit underneath the federal civil service system provides for their employees and for their former spouses,
mm-hmm.
and both for the former spouses of federal civil service individuals and for military former spouses. There are health care options available to them that can be long-term. And what I'm talking about long-term, exceeding the typical 36 months that you see underneath COBRA. And everybody knows what COBRA health insurance is.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be indefinite. That is, for as long as they need it.
Wow.
And just qualifying them is the important thing at the time of the divorce, because if you don't qualify them and give them what they need to have to be qualified underneath the health care benefits,
mm-hmm.
then they can't get it later.
Sure, sure. Again, prevention is better than preparing.
That's right.
Are there survivor benefits for military and federal civil service employees, and can they be awarded to a former spouse as a part of divorce?
Yes, they can be. They can actually be awarded today to same-sex couples, even in Georgia,
mm-hmm.
who doesn't recognize same-sex marriages. And that's a developing area of the law that I've recently been lecturing on to the state bar and to other people. But Georgia is perhaps a couple of years away from recognizing same-sex marriages. At least that's what's the talk on the street. It may be 2 to 3 years. But still, same-sex couples in Georgia can talk about and can arrange for some of these survivor benefits and health care benefits, even though Georgia doesn't recognize them. So they're very important, Emily, because without them, the right to receive a court-awarded portion of a pension ends upon the employee's or the service member's death. And many lawyers overlook those. They just, and in fact, if they don't understand the nuances of it, they can be woefully misled at mediation or settlement conferences or even in court to not do what needs to be done to ensure that the former spouse gets them.
Right, right. Now, let's talk about children. We've talked about former spouses, and children are obviously very important and will be contenders for this, receiving these benefits. How is the gross monthly income of military parents determined for child support?
Well, let me say something before I get into just say this. The one unique, and I'm sure Sean will agree with me on this, something that's unique about military families and federal civil service families is that they're highly transitory. In the military, in my 22 years that I was in an active duty military service, my family and I relocated 17 times. And that averages about every year and a half. Right. And that included overseas assignments, and you come under entirely different sets of laws. Even if you're a United States military person and you're assigned in Germany, you're still subject to certain types of laws like the International Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction and Enforcement Act. So it's kind of crazy, and you've got to understand those unique rules. Particularly, that's something that's significant is for military families is deployments. And whenever a mother has custody of her two children and she happens to be a warrant officer in the United States, or excuse me, in the Georgia Army National Guard, what happens to her children when she's deployed?
Right.
I mean, who gets them? And what happens when she comes back? And there's some real sad, sad stories that came up in the last 13 years we've been involved in the war on terror of mothers, Emily, perhaps your age, who had custody of two very beautiful children, and when she came back home, they were gone, and she never found them.
Oh,
so, I mean, that's really happened. In determining the income of military parents, Georgia is unique in that we do not consider all of the allowances and all of the pay benefits that a service member may receive. Based upon legislation that I helped, that I authored and I helped sponsor through the Georgia General Assembly as part of the Child Support Commission, the only thing that is considered is the base pay of the military member, their basic allowance for subsistence, and then only that portion of their housing allowance, which does not include variable area housing cost. So if you had a sergeant that was stationed in Atlanta, which is a higher cost living area than one who is stationed in Valdosta, Georgia, their income for child support purposes would be the same. And that becomes very significant when you have a father, non-custodial father, for instance, that is assigned in Tokyo, Japan, Paris, or Moscow as part of embassy detail, and they are having huge cost of living and housing allowances provided to them. Those are not included in Georgia. And as a result, we don't have child support orders that are larger than the net income of service members. And I've seen that. I've seen cases where judges had ordered child support based upon the entire pay of a service member. And by the time he got his paycheck, he was minus $50 in the hole before he bought toothpaste.
Wow.
So we changed that in Georgia. And since 2008, Georgia only considers those three components.
Well, that's wonderful.
It really is. And a lot of lawyers don't know it. A lot of judges don't know it.
Right.
And even though it's been the law for a long time, they just don't go to the statutes and check it.
Sure, sure, which is why we have our specialties. to do that. So I guess when you're looking for an attorney, make sure they definitely specialize in what your case is about and not just a general practice attorney. Would you agree?
Well, as I said, Sean and I are common in that our clientele base, they're unique. I mean, when you got a federal employee or you got a military person, they're different than everybody else, Emily. Mm-hmm. They're special.
Well, I would love to hear more, but we do have some other guests here in the room as well.
Well, thank you for letting me spend so much time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you'll just tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you.
Sure. I do a statewide consulting service to lawyers and to clients. You know, I may not be able to be their lead counsel, but I can associate with their primary attorney in their hometown or wherever.
Okay.
And I've also done that on a national basis. They can contact me at my email address at wmj.camp@wpmlegal.com. And I have a personal website. It's called John Camp, johncamplaw.com. And my office number in Warner Robins is 478-328-8316.
Well, thank you so much, and we look forward to having you back.
Thank you.
Yes, and Benin made it.
Yes, I did.
We're glad to have you, and you were actually on the After Hours show not too long ago.
That's right.
So we'll hear a little bit more from you. You only got like 5 minutes on that show. So, and Benin is in the helping attorneys business. He is with Brown Webb Copy. Give me 1 second. He is one of the few people that you will meet in Atlanta that was actually born and raised here. Mr. Brown is a digital media specialist at the John Marshall Law School in Atlanta, and he's also a freelance writer. You help attorneys with their websites, their social media. Tell me more.
Okay, so basically what I do is I help service providers such as attorneys to craft their message in a way that's engaging and that provides value to their audience. A lot of times clients will come to me and they're like, you know, Benin, in the type of work that I do, it's, you know, I'm not sure if it's suited for social media or those types of venues because it's just not exciting.
Right.
So one of the challenges is to try to find ways to help it engage their audience.
That's great. Yeah. So I'm guessing you learn a lot about what they do, the ins and outs, so that you can really understand.
Exactly.
Tell me, what is content marketing?
Okay. So content marketing is a form of marketing that relies heavily on content. Usually when people think of content marketing, we think of textual content that you find on websites, but it also includes other types of content as well, such as video and audio, podcasts, such as the venue that we're on now. And so, you know, it's taking all of these different forms of digital media and using it to sort of cut through the clutter and craft a message in a way that provides value to your audience so that, you know, they know that you're not just some, you know, just another person out there just trying to sell them something, basically.
Gotcha. So is it different? Is content marketing different or the same as social media marketing?
They're very similar.
Okay.
In fact, the two go hand in hand. So both social media marketing is a lot more new than content marketing.
Mm-hmm, sure.
I like to think of content marketing as sort of predating, even modern marketing. I mean, you think of, even going back through history when you had, people that would just get around and grab a meal together and talk and share stories with each other. That is actually a form of content marketing.
Ah.
You know, it's about, finding a story and some commonality, connecting with your audience, and using content as the medium to do that.
Kind of like networking.
Exactly. Whereas social media marketing is more or less using the social media vehicles, social networking sites, to help you to persuade an audience to do something that you want them to do.
Sure. Now, how important is content marketing, and how important would social media marketing be? I guess answer the first one.
Okay. Well, both of them are really important, especially in this day and age, as we see so many, you know, the amount of messages that we get on a daily basis has just expanded exponentially over the last, you know, even 5 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, you open up your email inbox.
Oh, my gosh.
And there's a ton of, you know, there's a million emails in there.
So overwhelming.
Yeah. So basically, it's to the point where, as a society, we've developed the tolerance to push-driven marketing campaigns. Anything where it looks like someone is actually actively pursuing you to get you to listen, we're automatically, like, immune to it. Like, you know, I'm good.
Right, no matter what you have.
Exactly. Whereas with content marketing, it's sort of the opposite approach. It's sort of like taking something that the person is interested in, mm-hmm. and sort of, you know, putting it in front of them and letting them experience it for themselves. And if they like it and if they connect with it and they like you, then mm-hmm. chances are that they will be open to hearing more about what you do.
So, so really it's building relationships too.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, you also do copywriting. Can you tell me a little more about that?
Sure. Well, copywriting and traditional marketing and social media marketing, they sort of all work hand in hand. I kind of think of copywriting as sort of the bridge between the two.
Okay.
Copywriting, you know, is essentially about selling with words. Particularly written words or words that appear on a website. It's one thing to have, you know, to do frequent blog posts or, mm-hmm. you know, frequent social media updates. But then it's another thing entirely to be able to take those non-threatening messages and add some, you know, an action to the end of it that makes sense to your audience. And that's
sure.
sort of where the copywriting comes into play.
Okay. So as far as content, especially, like, let's just give an example for an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
What type of content should that attorney be creating?
That's a really good question. One of the things that I like to encourage attorneys to pursue is to take a look at some of the question and answer websites such as Avvo and, you know, some of and even Quora and even Yahoo Answers, and see what the audience is already asking of them. And it's, you know, once you hone in on that and put an inventory of questions together, it's definitely a good idea to craft your content around that and sort of, you know, start answering those questions. Another thing that I'm really beginning to like is on LinkedIn. LinkedIn has a new content publishing platform called Pulse. And I'm noticing that a lot of service professionals, such as attorneys, are beginning to use that platform, and it's nice because it's a, you know, if you do any sort of business to business law,
mm-hmm.
it's a really non-threatening platform. It's really engaging, and it's really good for just establishing your authority and mm-hmm. building your presence.
That is nice. I haven't heard of that yet. I'll mm-hmm. have to take advantage myself.
Oh, definitely.
I've been working on my LinkedIn recently, if you've noticed.
Definitely, I have.
So I know also that attorneys write publications,
mm-hmm.
And they're required to.
Mm-hmm.
Is it something that you do? Do you do any type of ghostwriting for attorneys?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, my background before, you know, even working, coming on board with John Marshall, is I worked for an attorney marketing firm and handled their SEO and you know, I've always been a writer ever since college. I just love to write.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, one of the things that I've helped a lot of attorneys with is you know, practice, you know, helping them to improve their practice area pages and on their websites, as well as things like their local area pages on their
mm-hmm.
websites, basically things that are designed to sort of not only engage their audience, but also to get the attention of the search engines. So mm-hmm. yes, that is something that I've done, as well as helping with things like landing pages that are designed to, you know, help their audience take some form of action.
Because I know that they're very busy.
Definitely.
And they might not have the time to effectively market. Tell me, how does somebody go about crafting a content marketing strategy, and is it difficult, and is it going to take a long time?
Well,
or a lot of time, a lot of their time.
Well, that's a really good question. You know, by its very nature, it is a fairly intensive process.
Mm-hmm.
It really involves sort of taking a step back and evaluating their business goals.
Sure.
You know, because all marketing is driven ultimately by your business goals. So once a firm has a good grasp of what they're wanting to do, mm-hmm. as well as what their strengths and weaknesses are, mm-hmm. they can take that and sort of mesh it together with what their audience is looking for and what what other attorneys are doing, and sort of craft a plan around that's designed to help meet their goals.
And for them to stand out.
Right. And I mean, generally, I've seen some attorneys and service providers try to do it on their own. And that's certainly something that, it's certainly something that you can do. However, I found that, with all the other things competing for your attention,
sure.
it is really helpful to have the support of someone that can provide an objective viewpoint of what you're doing.
Right, right. Now, is there a way to measure their marketing strategy and to track the effectiveness?
Absolutely. There sure is. One of the things that I like to do to measure the effectiveness of different strategies is to use the analytics that are built into platforms such as Facebook.
Gotcha.
Twitter actually has a really good analytics program as well. And a lot of folks aren't aware that it actually does have really robust analytics. And then my favorite is Google Analytics.
Mm-hmm.
Google Analytics will actually allow you to get code and basically wrap any link that you put on your website or social media with special codes that, where you can track it directly in the Google Analytics
mm-hmm.
dashboard to see what people are doing once they click your link, to see if they're actually going any further than that and mm-hmm. signing up or, making phone. You can even do phone call tracking through Google Analytics.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely a lot of ways to track the effectiveness of what you're doing online.
And I know a lot of attorneys get tons of referrals as well. But would you say that social media could be sort of like a referral generating tool?
Definitely. Definitely. I would definitely say that it can be like a referral source. And one of the kind of a nice bridge between the social media and referral sources for attorneys is these meetup groups, meetup
mm-hmm.
on meetup.com.
Mm-hmm.
They provide a really good avenue because, on the one hand, since that website, meetup.com, is updated so frequently,
mm-hmm.
It tends to do really well in search engines. A lot of times, if you have a good profile page on that particular site, you could come up higher in the search results there than you might on your own web page.
Oh, wow.
And then in addition to that, when you go to these groups, you can also meet some great people and make some, some great connections.
Right. Now, one more question for you.
Sure.
You were saying that, you could get results that are, higher than your web page, but
mm-hmm.
it all does come back to your web page. So
mm-hmm.
how important is it to have a well-working, good content-driven website?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm glad you asked it, Emily. It's really important because, what often happens as business people and marketers is we're human too, and a lot of times if there's no driving a strategy driving what you're doing, what we will do as business people, attorneys and so forth, is build a website according to what we like and what we think the audience likes.
Mm-hmm.
And it might not necessarily be the same thing as what your audience likes. So, that's a good reason as to why someone would, look to a marketing specialist to help them figure out, okay, what does your audience want?
Sure.
And how can you, provide what they want and do it in a way that also helps you to meet your goals as well.
Right. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. And how would our listeners get in touch with you if they wanted to learn more?
Okay. I can be reached at brownwebcopy.com. That's my website. Once again, it's brown like the color, webcopy.com. My phone number is 404-492-6088. And I'm also on LinkedIn. And if you do a search for Benin Brown, B-E-N-I-N, I should come up right on LinkedIn.
We would hope so. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
My co-host over here is kind of dropping the ball today. I'm just kidding.
I've been all over Twitter and sending photos out and getting a lot of retweets and conversations. So,
that's great.
But I've been also somewhat engaged in the conversation and trying to wear all these hats. But I had a couple of comments, a couple of questions. Benin, first, on your website, it says CEO of Brown Knows Content, right? Is that like... But also, you could steal the what can Brown do for you? That's already taken, whatever, right?
Right.
But what's this? I love this comment too. SEO content ninja within.
Uh huh.
Yeah. And
well, okay. So awaken the SEO content ninja within is sort of just about helping. It's actually a piece of content that I wrote for someone else. And it was about, you know, how do you take content and write it in a way that attracts, you know, visitors through the search engines, and how do you do it in a way that doesn't go overboard, you know?
And speaking of content, I've thought about this. I've tossed this idea, and I'll get some free advice from you while we're on the air, put you on the spot here. Right?
Sure.
But we've done quite a number of shows for different underwriters or our in-house show and, of course, Atlanta Legal Experts. Mm-hmm. We're thinking there is so much content within our shows archived. Matter of fact, we just discovered yesterday on iTunes that all the shows are archived on there.
Yeah.
Right? I sent out that link. But we could potentially take each of these shows. Mm-hmm. And there's a source that can transcribe those for you in writing, right?
Right.
Take that and send it back to each guest. Mm-hmm. Say, here's your entire conversation with Emily, the Q&A conversation and your talking points. We could,
wow.
Right? And that could send that. They could then post that, just copy and paste and post it on their blog. Yes, yes or yes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. Matter of fact, that's a really good strategy. That's a really good strategy that I definitely recommend someone do is take whatever content they already have and sort of repurpose it into other forms of content. Like text can be turned into video, video can be turned into text, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I just discovered that like on YouTube, there's a button or something like that. You can take your entire YouTube, you know, we're working on posting all the shows, not the video, but the audio on YouTube, because I learned also that the second most searched search engine, if that's YouTube.
That's right.
Second only to Google.
That's right.
Right? So that's a great platform as well. A couple other questions. We have a minute here.
Yeah,
absolutely. Okay, so for really kind of observation for the folks with federal employment attorneys, right?
Sean
and Tarina, thank you. I'm scrambling a bunch of screens here. But I'm looking at your website as well, and I guess, you know, obviously Emily talked about this during the segment as well, but you've helped federal employees litigation with the U.S. Postal Service, Department of Veterans Affairs, Department of Defense, NASA. I mean, there must be some great stories there, right?
Yes, but unfortunately I can't.
Yeah, exactly.
It's pretty exciting.
Yeah, but you guys aren't responsible for the postage going up, are you, or by a penny?
I hope not, but it would be worth it, I think.
Yeah, so we'd have to invite you back if there's any of those... cases you can talk about kind of hypothetical without mentioning any names or is that possible or no?
I think it might be possible. I know we have a few clients who have been asking us to do that. We're thinking about that, but
or maybe often. Have them on and tell their success story or whatever with y'all.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sounds like a good idea.
Yes or yes?
Yes.
And then finally a couple of observation or point with John here. I was looking at your site as well. And I don't know if this came up during the interview. I was busy taking pictures and on social media, Twitter. But you were the Assistant General Counsel for the National NSA for the and Deputy Staff Judge Advocate to General Norman Schwarzkopf during the Desert Storm and Desert Shield?
Yes, I was.
Wow. So we'll have to talk off the air. I don't know if you can discuss any of that. Is that still sealed documents or what?
Well, a non-disclosure agreement that I signed with the National Security Agency does prevent me from talking about many of their sources and methods. My experience is as General Schwarzkopf's Deputy Staff Judge Advocate is a very exciting period of my life. And some of the things that I did last on, I wrote General Order Number 1 for Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and and literally I was assigned that at 11 o'clock at night, and it had to be on the president's desk at 6 a.m. the next morning. Imagine never having written an order like that, or one never having been written. But that order essentially limited the constitutional benefits or constitutional privileges of United States service members, 500,000 of them, that were being deployed to the Middle East to kick Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. And 20-plus years later, that order is still in place and still being used. But it touched on everything from possession of pornography and alcohol to sex in the battlefield or in the combat zone, to alcohol and to religious practices. One of the largest numbers, in fact, we gave out more Article 15s and court-martials to chaplains who were proselytizing in Saudi Arabia, if you can imagine it.
Yeah. You should write one for the Secret Service or whatever. Could you?
Well, I'm just going to tell you, just the things that went on were crazy.
You could write a book, right?
I mean,
well, if you could, but yeah.
But I mean, one of the most humorous stories were stories of service members making alcohol and beer in their bathtubs, which were illegal, to doing pornography.
Wow.
I mean, they couldn't get a hold of any pornography, so they were making their own. And Emily would appreciate this, I'm sure, as would you. Women over there, women who were deployed with the armed forces at the time, went into a country that did not have the types of personal items that they needed, and including clothing items. And so they started ordering them from Victoria's Secret. And, of course, as these huge orders for bras and underwear was coming in, Victoria's Secret started shipping pallets of their catalogs. And whenever they came in, the Saudis just went crazy over it because that was pornography to them. Mm-hmm. And more people got 20 lashes out in the courthouse square for possessing a
catalog.
Oh, wow.
So we had to shred those things to make sure that they didn't get into the wrong hands.
You just sent them to Sears and Roebuck catalog. They're fine then.
Well, I remember those from the 1960s.
Right, I was going to say, you can't speak to it because of non-disclosure. Maybe you can hire Benin to be your ghostwriter and write all these great stories. Yeah. So, all right, that's all I have for the panel here, yeah.
And thank you for your service.
Thank you. Yeah,
too. Thank you very much.
We're just so honored to have everybody here today. I think this was a great show. So.
Oh, big time. I mean, great stories. And Benin, good to have you back in the studio. And,
thanks.
And kudos on your new venture there, yeah.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me back.
All right, this is Emily Rowell with the Peachtree Offices. And you can find my website at peachtreeoffices.com and reach me at 404-250-3200. And you can also listen to all the shows at www.atlantalegalexperts.com. And we will see you next week.
Yeah, see you on the radio.